It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The Trump era has clearly left its mark on American politics. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. But how did his rise to the most powerful political office in the country come about? What are the dynamics that led him to best all other traditional Republican comers in the 2016 election? And what does he leave behind once he departs from office? Bradford Kane is author of Pitchfork Populism, 10 Political Forces That Shaped an Election and Continue to Change America. He began his career with Democratic Congresswoman Curtis Collins of Illinois. He's been involved in the government relations consulting firm Coalition on Media Concerns, and he joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Don. Thanks very much for having me.
So let me ask you this. We have obviously in the midst of a coronavirus, a pandemic, and as I look at the style that the president has displayed, at least so far, it seems to be very reminiscent of the kind of style that he had when he ran in 2016 to essentially beat all comers.
Sure does. All the same forces that were in play then are very much in microcosm right here with Corona.
So tell me then a little bit about what you see his style being.
Sure. So first of all, one of the central themes of my book is, as in chapter one, the United States has a split identity personality between individualism and collectivism. Both sides are equally legitimate. Both sides are deeply rooted in our culture, going all the way back to colonial days. And Donald Trump is obviously an individualist, but to an extreme. So first of all, of course, we all remember in 2016 when he said, "I alone can fix it." That spoke volumes because he does see himself as the centerpiece of everything, which is why every day's briefings, he wants to be there. At first, he was basically informed by his staff that he really should let Vice President Pence lead the briefings because he was the chair of the task force. And Donald Trump didn't like Pence getting all of that media attention, and Trump wanted to be the center of that. So he reinserted himself, and we see his personality play out in all respects. The thing is, individualism is one thing; it's a philosophy. In Donald Trump's case, he quite clearly believes himself to be the supreme individual, not just individualism, but everything's about him. That's not just a commentary. That's evident in everything he does, in his actions as president throughout this term, where he places himself at the center of things. Now, it's really unfortunate because, as I discuss in Chapter 3 of Pitchfork Populism, that most presidents act out of policy and principles. In this case, Trump is really guided by his personality and his psychological needs. It's something that we don't usually discuss as per the Goldwater rule, where, we don't normally talk about, someone's psychology. But in Donald Trump's case, because of his Twitter feed and his comments that are basically unfiltered, he puts his personality and psychology in the public domain on a daily basis. And for us to ignore it is irresponsible, because he's the one putting it front and center. So the interesting thing about how all this plays out is that individualism is not what's called for in Corona. This is clearly a situation where collectivism is the road to success, and we're seeing that beautifully, because as Dr. Tony Fauci, who's an American treasure, as he's been explaining this week, as he's been changing the models that talk about the number of cases and the tragic deaths that will result, they've been ratcheting down the numbers because they've been finding that Americans have been following the CDC and Dr. Fauci's guidelines even more than anticipated. That's collectivism. That's where Americans care not just about how does this affect me, but how does this affect my neighbor? How does this affect the community? People are staying at home much more so. Whether or not it's because of risk to themselves, Americans have been persuaded by the public health officials that even if you don't do it for yourself, do it for people you care about. And even if there aren't that many people, it's still the community. So people are following the orders. We all see it. We all see pictures on the television of streets that are deserted. That's because of collectivism, where people are rallying together. And the solution is, as a whole, doing the right things, washing our hands, staying at home, and so that we don't put the strain on the healthcare system. And that is a theme that is that runs counter to the way the Trump White House is trying to lead this.
Larry Sabato, the political scientist, has called Trump a cult, and Trump's rise to power seems to be compared to, say, the Jacksonian era, which moved away from the elites that really sort of framed the country in the first place to the populace at large. How accurate do you think that is?
Actually, I see that differently.
Go ahead.
With all great respect for
sure.
Professor Sabato, who's really tremendous. The part of the reason why I titled the book Pitchfork Populism is that this is actually not populism. It's a faux populism. So populism in the United States, whether we're talking about the economic populism and agrarian populism going back to the 1800s and with William Jennings Bryan and other true populist leaders, basically populism usually is the empowerment of the masses so that the will of the masses and their agenda and their needs come to the fore, and then there's usually a leader who embodies that and advances it, but they're doing it for basically for elevation of the needs of the masses. In Trump's case, his form of populism, which I call pitchfork populism, is basically where he motivates his base to empower him. It's not empowerment of the masses, it's empowerment of him. So he's beholden to his base because they are the ones that fuel him, and he's able to use that as leverage against other Republicans, basically threatening that, with his tweets he'll steer people against them, and then they are very concerned. Some of them even cower to his his whim because they don't want to, bear the wrath of what he could bring upon them by turning his base against them. But basically what it is that by motivating that base, their voting power in the Republican Party is strong enough that it gives Donald Trump the leverage that he has to wield over others. So that's a distinction from traditional populism, which is really all about the needs and the agenda of elevating and empowering the masses.
So how do you see his base in terms of the overarching change that's taking place in the United States then?
Well, that's a fascinating thing, which has very direct implications for November, for the November election. People look at Donald Trump's job approval numbers. So you can start, of course, with November of 2016, and look at him getting 46.1% of the vote. So some people point to 46.1, but now of course we're years later, and what we mostly have to work with now are job approval numbers. That does not reflect Donald Trump's base. As I put forth the argument in Chapter 10 of the book, Donald Trump's base is actually a fraction of that. And that is clear based on when you look at when his numbers, his job approval numbers were the lowest. You can see that there were some people who never left his side, that were always supporting him. And between my calculation of this, but informed by a panoply of pollsters and other folks, basically Donald Trump's hardcore base that is immutable is only 20 to 25%. That means that another 20% of people who are inclined to either support him or give him a positive job approval number now as opposed to election day but for the time being, that other 20% is gettable, is reachable, is maybe inclined toward voting for a Republican, maybe because they are Republican registered voters or because they typically vote Republican, but they are not part of his base. There are many reasons why people voted for Donald Trump in 2016. It wasn't just, there were some people who loved Donald Trump, but there were other people who, there are a number of reasons, but a lot of those reasons no longer apply. So, for example, one of those reasons, some people were disenchanted with both parties, and they wanted to shake up the system. And so they thought, I'll take a chance with Donald Trump. There is no one in America today who can say that they don't know what Donald Trump is. There, you can love him, you can hate him, whatever you think. There's no one who can say, I don't know, he's an X factor. Everyone has opinions of Donald Trump. Everyone's got plenty of evidence to see, how he does what he does. So that right there is one of the reasons why many people voted for him. That simply doesn't apply in 2020. So when you look forward to the election in November, and you break down who among his supporters is hardcore with him, yes, there is his base, but that is by no means his job approval number by no means reflects his broad, immutable support, and there's a lot in the middle, both independents, disenchanted Republicans, third parties, a lot of people who could very well be brought to Joe Biden's side, for example.
I want to take a look at the Republican Party a moment in terms of race, because one of the things that struck me is the 1960s and going into the 1970s, the Republican Party basically moved away from its Lincolnian roots and basically scooped up the white South, also along with a white cultural backlash that was occurring at the time. But the portion of the population that is white has been diminishing over time. I've been told that if the population had reflected, say, when Reagan was elected president, then say that with same population, say what was in 2012, that Romney would be president. It does seem as if there's a diminishing problem, a demographic problem that Republicans have. And if you obviously look at ahead, you're going to see that the minorities ultimately, I think, by about 2042, that they're going to represent just a little over 50%. So there seems to be something else going on, particularly in terms of minorities, in terms of the Republican Party and its prospects moving forward.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. In Chapter 2 of the book, I talk about demographics, and there is a demographic shift happening in the United States. This is a fascinating thing, and it ties directly back to your our previous discussion in terms of the Trump base. Part of what he organized his base around is he recognized, to Trump's credit, he recognized that there were a lot of whites, mostly Republicans, but also people who are not affiliated with the party, who were concerned either for, in some cases, there is latent racism. In some cases, it's overt racism. And let me just throw in a caveat right there. It's offensive to suggest that all Trump voters are racist, but it is also offensive to suggest that there aren't overt racists among Trump's voters. There absolutely are, but once again, by no means are all Trump voters racist. So the important thing about his base is that one of the main elements that Trump used in order to organize the base and consolidate his base was fear and resentment and grievance. And he, instead of just acknowledging it, he tapped it, he exacerbated it, he made it a focal point. Everything from when he came down the escalator and he basically slandered basically the Mexican-American population and immigrants, to innumerable situations. What he said after the Charlottesville violence and how he has been basically genuflecting toward racial policy, more anti-racial policies, in terms of policies that are targeted against either Muslims or blacks or Hispanics. You know, there's a long list of things that he's done and said, and also for that matter, at his Justice Department, they have turned affirmative action upside down. There are all kinds of things. You can even see it by his appointees. But the important thing about that is that, very interestingly, in Maryland, the former Lieutenant Governor, Michael Steele, who then went on to chair the National Republican Party, he basically was putting forth an agenda of recognizing exactly what you pointed out and realizing that he needed to update the Republican Party to make it more of a broad tent and recognize the demographic shift and appeal to a broader swath of Americans, including people of various ethnicities and racial backgrounds. All of that was washed aside by Donald Trump, which is why, you know, Michael Steele has, you know, we've heard him be very vocal in the problems that he has with the way Donald Trump does his politics. So as opposed to that wing of the Republican Party that wanted to be part of contemporary America, Donald Trump is narrowing his focus. He makes his appeal very white-centric with elevating the grievance mentality, and that will not serve him well in November, but even worse than that, it hurts the Republican Party long term, and that doesn't really serve anyone's interest.
Well, let me say to follow up on that quickly, and that is, if I ask you to look into the crystal ball, what do you see the Republican Party in, say, 20 years or 30 years? Are they going to continue to grasp on to this diminishing portion of the electorate and the population, or will it split? I mean, I don't see a major issue, say, for instance, when the Whigs split over slavery, for example, but what, I mean, can it be maintain its cohesiveness, or is it going to shrink? I mean, what, if you were to project out?
I don't think most Republicans agree with Donald Trump. I think most Republicans are true Americans in the sense of recognizing that we are a polyglot society. We are made up of, e pluribus unum, of many, one. And this is kind of, I see it as one particular segment. You know, of course, the Republican Party is a coalition party, the same way that the Democratic Party is a coalition party. It's just different coalitions. So Republican Party is made up of many tracks, of many strands. So yes, there will still be the strand that is very Trumpian and that puts these kind of, you know, these worries and resentment and fear at the forefront. But most Republicans are not of that nature. So the Republican Party will continue, but as I anticipate, if Trump is defeated in November 2020, as I and others anticipate, you know, with a lot of factors there, of course, and the Democratic Party has to, you know, do all the right moves and run a solid campaign and everything. But if that happens, I anticipate that a lot of Republicans, most Republicans, are going to run away from Trumpism very, very quickly and repudiate the basically Trumpism and try to embrace a broader swath of the population with traditional Republican values. And there will be, you know, we'll have those kind of, you know, policy fights, and that's all a good thing. That's what America does. We're not all of the same mind on things, and that's fine if we have different policy arguments. But I do not anticipate that the Republican Party will still stay attached to these kinds of antipathies and vilification that Donald Trump has made his calling card.
Well, let me make this observation, which is, it seems to me, and particularly as I look back, that the Republican Party made a very sharp turn in 1994 with Newt Gingrich and this sort of scorched earth policy, highly partisan, very strong shift to the right. And of course, many of those people now look moderate by today's standards, but it created the Tea Party, the Freedom Caucus. And it seems to me that those moderate Republicans who wanted a tax cut or wanted less government regulation, they rode that tiger into the White House with Donald Trump. And it seems to me it's going to be a very, very difficult for them to extract themselves from that feature of their rise to power.
Well, there's a major difference. What happened in the 1990s was very policy-based, basically Gingrich and others tapped into a different mindset, and you know, that certainly definitely happened. What Trump has done, though, is very personality-focused, and it goes back to something you said before about the cult of personality, as Professor Sabato has talked about. The thing that is so strange is that a lot of Republicans, especially Trump's base, basically have switched over to basically empower an individual. We see Donald Trump's authoritarian inclinations coming out very, very strong. There's a part of my book where I talk about the drivers, his impulses. There are five main elements that propel his actions. And basically, a lot of the Republican Party has basically wanted to have this strong authoritarian leader, which is so counter to American democracy and so counter to what's in our Constitution. But also, if you look back at what our founders expressed as concerns and fears about one person having, you know, too much power, that's one of the strange things. So could the Republican Party go back to a lot of the, you know, first of all, the Republican Party has never left certain philosophical pillars, some of which were embodied in the Gingrich movement, and then there are others that are more contemporary from recent years. But this is kind of, it's kind of pushing the envelope. It's the rubber band is being pulled, and I really anticipate that there will be a pendulum swing away from putting all their eggs in the basket of a person in whom they want to cede all their authority and basically hoping that person will you know, guide them. It'll be much more, a lot of Republicans will be empowered. You're going to find new Republicans running for office wanting to get back to Republican values instead of just, you know, placing their faith in an authoritarian.
Turning to the media, we obviously now have new terms like fake news. We have alternative facts, and we have a multiplicity of media outlets now, as opposed to the tradition that maybe perhaps I or you grew up with, which were gatekeepers of people who would actually assess the validity of any particular claim. Now the claims are simply out there, and they seem to be siloed in terms of individual political inclinations, from Fox News to Breitbart, for example. How do you read the impact of that changing media landscape into this thing that we're now seeing played out with Trump and beyond?
It is enormous. And, you know, what the centerpiece of this, and I talk about this in Chapter 5 where I talk about the media, I discuss it in terms of the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that with all these new technology solutions that we have, well, first of all, they're, you know, with cable TV, but then the internet and all, you know, everything in social media, everyone can have a voice, and there's the platforms are open for anyone who is, wants to, you know, put forth an opinion, but also especially those who do so with some, you know, amount of, you know, articulation and reach out to people. So the door is open for people to participate, and that's, I consider that to be a good thing. The bad news with that is that there's no common set of facts, nothing that we all recognize. For example, for those who remember the days of Walter Cronkite, when he spoke, America recognized that, you know, they recognized what were facts and what was truth. So that's unfortunate that we have this fragmentation. The ugly is that because of this siloization, where different folks get their news from different sources, some people are using that to manipulate the minds of the malleable. Those who are willing to be fed false information are provided an opportunity for that. So that's one of the things we see every day, like during the Corona briefings. Donald Trump puts forth falsehoods on a regular basis. For example, Of course, you know, early on in the Corona, he was basically saying, "Oh, this is no big deal. Everything is great. We have 15 cases. It'll go down to zero. There will be a miracle," and on and on and on. And now he claims, "Oh no, I was on top of this from the beginning." No, Donald Trump, you were not. He was the person who was saying, who was basically minimizing this at the same time that the intelligence committee, the intelligence community, recognized in November of last year that there was this problem, and then even some of his own staff put forth memos. Even yesterday, as recently as yesterday, Donald Trump was trying to finesse his way out of it, saying, "I didn't see the memos." That doesn't mean he didn't know about the memos. We know he doesn't read memos. We've heard that from tons of his staff. So when he says, "I didn't see the memo," I believe that because he's notorious for not reading memos. Was he briefed on it? He left that wide open. He knew about it, but he also said, "I don't remember." That's the same kind of thing he was saying during the whole situation with Special Prosecutor Mueller. "I don't remember." But then he says, "I didn't see it." That's falsehood. This is where he's trying to manipulate his base and the minds of the malleable. Compare that to those who want to approach everything based on facts. That's one of the reasons why Dr. Fauci is so indispensable and a national hero, is because he's approaching Corona from a factual basis, and that's what gives America, and for that matter, beyond America, a lot more confidence that even when there's bad news, you have to know what the truth is so people can have certainty and explanations. And Joe Biden, for example, is someone who operates out of facts. He is science-based. He is fact-based. And, you know, these are the kind of things that make a huge difference for American confidence, not just on Corona, but on everything. When we're talking about international relations and climate change and domestic policies, Joe Biden is someone who aligns himself with facts, whereas Donald Trump is basically putting forth his own, you know, personal best interests at every opportunity.
Finally, just briefly, it does seem to me that what Trump has done over the years as to emphasize the narrative over facts and over things that might be inconvenient. So that, for instance, and he uses, for instance, labels, such as he labels something as a hoax or it's fake news, which means that you don't have to evaluate the fact in and of itself. It does seem to me as if he has gotten a hold of at least a dynamic within society in which the narrative is more important than reality.
That's absolutely right, and that's why that gets back to his base that basically will support him no matter what. And when he is putting forth falsehoods, he's basically trying to reinforce his base for his political interests. But really, the whole thing with Donald Trump, it gets back to his psychology. He's always seeking validation. He's always seeking praise. He's basically making up for whatever it is that he's lacking. He wants to associate himself with people, a certain type of people. He puts forth these narratives where he is never to blame. Just the other day, he was going after the World Health Organization, saying that it's their fault. You know, basically, he never wants to acknowledge that he makes a mistake or anything. It is partly a political move to reinforce his base, and partly because he can't accept that there's anything that he does that is not the best or nothing that he does is wrong, because that impairs him as a human being. Whereas most people who are confident and secure in what they do and who they are, that they have a more reasoned approach and they can acknowledge that, you know, here's a strength, here's a weakness. Not Donald Trump. He only wants to see things. He needs to place himself above the rest, and that leads to his false narratives that are constant, which get into how he also manipulates his base with his continued messages like that.
Bradford Kane is author of Pitchfork Populism, 10 Political Forces That Shaped an Election and Continue to Change America. This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio.